Depression is more than just feeling sad from time to time. Depression is more than just having the blues. Clinically, depression is defined as a feeling of sadness, hopelessness, and disinterest in life, lasting for over 2 weeks, that interferes with daily activities. Some of you may know that depression can interfere so much that one can't even get themselves out of bed. Depression is a disease that affects the brain. And on a soul level, religious educator Parker Palmer writes, "Depression is the ultimate state of disconnection, depriving one of the lifeline of every living being." Parker Palmer knows because he is someone who has suffered from bouts of depression throughout his life, and he's written extensively about his own depression. Now, I've had the blues before. I've experienced sadness that lasts for days. I've had times when I felt more spiritually alive and times when I felt less connected to myself and others. But I've never had what I have seen in others as a major depression and what I've heard described to me. People I know, family, friends, congregants, who struggle with this kind of clinical depression are challenged in a whole different way than the run-of-the-mill down feelings that arise for all of us during some parts of our lives. The mental anguish is enough for some to consider that death is better than what they're living through, as Heather described. And we also know that for far too many, that pain does get to the point where that option is acted upon. Depression is serious and an oh-so-painful inner dis-ease. At any point, 3 to 5% of the population are suffering from a major depressive episode, and the lifetime risk is about 17% of having one. So I want to invite you, if you are comfortable doing so, but really only if you are comfortable doing so, I want to invite you to raise your hand if you have been impacted by depression, either personally or by someone that you care about. Many of us are deeply, deeply touched. And depression, I find, is compounded perhaps more than any other disease by our cultural response to it. And you know what that is often? Stigma. Now, everyone should have the right to decide when and with whom they disclose anything about themselves, particularly their health problems. And in many cases, privacy is both appropriate and desirable. There is a difference, however, between something that we choose to keep private simply out of a personal preference, and those things that we feel that we must keep private in order to preserve our social standing, our jobs, or some basic legal rights, our housing, things like that. When we feel that we have to keep an illness or a part of ourselves a secret, as many do with psychological disorders, the feelings we are having are because of stigma, because the culture around us will not care for us the way we need to be cared for, whether that is actual or perceived. I was struck, oh, look at that. Wow. Sorry about that. I was struck by the definition of stigma that I found in the Oxford Dictionary. It was a mark of disgrace associated with a particular circumstance, quality, or person. Disgrace, not in grace, away from spirit, away from the divine, away from our connection to wholeness. And that mark is culturally driven, based on the context that we tell each other in a community. Stigma has been labeled the biggest barrier to mental health access by the Surgeon General, the biggest barrier. 3 out of 4 people with mental health issues say they've experienced stigma. Stigma in the outer world, that feeling of disgrace, intensifies the shame that depression feeds upon. Jungian analysts call shame the swampland of the soul. The swampland of the soul. And if that isn't the house of depression, I don't know what is. Now, popular speaker and social scientist Brené Brown does much of her research on shame. She actually says if she's in an airplane and she tells people, she talks about shame. She's, you know, the person next to them like, oh my God, like, you know, never want to, you know, oh, shame, right? Nobody wants to talk about shame. That's kind of part of shame's nature. Nobody wants to talk about shame. But I'm going to talk about shame because it's very connected to depression and how we relate to depression. So I want to distinguish between a couple of things. Guilt, I did something bad. Shame, I am bad. Do you see the difference? They're very important. So guilt can lead to self-improvement. It is uncomfortable, but adaptive. You can create that part in yourself that says, how do I do it better next time? Shame leads to self-deprecation. It's a downward spiral into that swampland. Now, Brené Brown reminds us that we all have shame. It's just a part of the human condition. And if you're out there thinking that you've never had shame, she says people who don't have shame are sociopaths. So I'm hoping that each of you can identify some part in yourself where a little bit of shame resides, right? Brené Brown talks about shame gremlins, and she takes it from the 1984 movie Gremlins. And they kind of scurry about in the dark. They feed depression. They feed depression, these gremlins, the shame that comes to us, by telling us two things. She says two things. I will add a third. One is you're not good enough. It's an inherent quality that you tell yourself. That's a shame quality. The other one is who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to really be able to do that, right? And the third one that I would say, which is key to depression, is you are alone. Disconnected. You are alone. Now that is spiritually and now even scientifically untrue. We are profoundly interconnected with one another. But depression will tell you you are alone. Shame, Brené Brown tells us, needs three things: silence, secrecy, and judgment. That's what it feeds on. So silence is so, I'm going to talk to you later, there's another kind of silence that is a beautiful silence. There's some silences that are about avoidance and discomfort. Not knowing what to say, so saying nothing. Secrecy. Secrecy, the hushed voices that you hear when people utter the words depression or addiction or anxiety. One of the social scientists I was reading about said he can't wait for the day when you will hear people in the supermarket in as loud a voice as they have talk about the addiction or the depression or the anxiety of someone they know in the same way that they would talk about someone having broken an ankle. Won't that be the day? Now here's the trick, here's the real catch. Judgment. Lots of people or lots of things don't intend to be judgment that come in as judgment, particularly to the depressed person. And the primary one is advice giving. You just think about it. Should and shame, first two letters are the same, so you can put those together in your mind, right? What was on that video? You should try yoga. Have you tried paleo? People offer advice because they want to be helpful. I offer advice all the time to people because I want to be helpful. I'm in a helping profession, for God's sake, right? But what happens, particularly for the depressed person, but for many of us, is what gets heard is, this is what I'm not doing. I'm not doing yoga. Shame on me. I have to change my diet. Why didn't I think about my diet? Shame on me. I'm not good enough. So while the intention for advice giving is caring, what comes in can often be shame-producing. That's a really tricky one. It's a really, really tricky one. Now, what Brené Brown would say, connected to shame, which is the primary feeder, a feeder of depression. And the reason she uses the movie Gremlins is because in that movie in 1984, as soon as you flip the lights on, they all scurried away. So what shame needs is the light switched on it. What it needs is people to shine a light, a dim light at first, not a floodlight, a dim light, to create the safe space for some of that feeling of aloneness to dissipate. Brené Brown would say empathy is one of the key things that help people feel less alone, less judged. I know that feeling. Or I can just imagine. Now for Parker Palmer, who also, as I said, suffered from depression, he said the best experience he ever had when he was having a major depressive episode where he could not get out of bed was not people telling him what a good writer he was and how he had to start writing again, was not people reminding him about what a beautiful day it was, but was his friend who came every single day and rubbed his feet, sat and rubbed his feet. And he might say, "You seem more relaxed today." Or, "You look tired." That kind of presence with a person is holy territory. It is being able to sit in the presence of pain and shine a light on it without an expectation that you have the power to change it. My most profound experiences in ministry and in friendship have had those kind of moments in them. They're transcendent moments when the feeling of a presence, of a holy mystery has been with me and the other person. When I have felt honored to shine a little bit of light on someone's deep shame. Just to listen and to witness to their pain and their struggle, letting those shame gremlins scurry away because they have no place to hide. Letting go of these shame gremlins can't be done alone. Have you ever tried to like read at night with a book light and whatever? The light, it's really hard to get the light in the right place. It's much easier to have someone else holding that flashlight for you. Now, Brené Brown is also very clear that someone else can't just be anyone, because otherwise more damage can be done. She talks about being able to trust and risk to share with someone who has earned your trust, that's vital to being able to move through the feelings that we have of those of despair. So I ask you, whose trust have you earned? Who do you think would come to you and you would be able to be that kind of a presence for them? Just there, shining a little bit of light so their soul can feel some relief and some connection. And who has earned your trust? Who would you turn to? Who do you turn to in times of struggle that you know can offer a holy presence to you? There's a big question about, you know, so here's what not to do. What do we do? Presence is key. But also just before one moves into that fixing mode, to ask, can I offer you a suggestion? And be willing to take no for an answer. And sometimes just the checking in with no expectation of what's going to happen at the other end can be vitally important to someone who feels that disconnection of depression, knowing there are others out there, even if they're not doing anything, but saying, "How are you?" These are simple and challenging acts, but can be so vitally important to someone who is suffering. So it is my hope that this congregation is earning the trust of those who have mental health issues. It is my hope that there are many, many moments when relationships of trust of all sorts are being developed. Because trust doesn't happen in an instant. It happens over time. It is my hope that our services, our prayers, our candles of community, our mental health support group, our organizing around mental health especially, which is doing everything it can to remove stigmas and provide better access to mental health. It is my hope that all of these things together are providing a place of solace and hope and light for anyone who walks through these doors. It is my hope that we have a light that purges stigma and shame and purges our illusions of separateness, a light that brings renewal and hope, a light that illumines our profound interconnection, because that is the truth of our existence. We are never alone. We are never alone. May this be our promise and our prayer together, my friends.